And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for the meeting, Mary F.
I could be WG from El Cajon if you want me to be. What the heck? Yeah, I could be from Poway, wherever you want. Hi, everybody. My name is Mary, and I am an alcoholic. And I am a member of the Golden Hill Sunday night discussion meeting at Pathfinders, and my sponsor is Keith M., and my sobriety date is October the 26th, 1984. And I am originally from New Jersey, and I'm extremely nervous tonight, so this is a pretty big crowd to be talking to. I'm a Jersey girl who moved to Florida in 1978, and that's where I got sober at. I got sober in Newport Richey, Florida. And I'll tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I didn't come from an alcoholic family. Neither my mother or my father were drinkers, so I wasn't raised in a home where I saw a lot of drinking going on. In fact, I didn't see any at all unless my aunt came to visit at Christmas time, and that was my mom's sister. And underneath the kitchen sink, there was lots of booze, and we call affectionately, we're Italian, and we affectionately called her Z.I., which is aunt in Italian. And Z.I. would come at Christmas time, and she would drink everything under the sink. And that was the extent of what I knew about alcoholism growing up. And then Z.I.'s husband, my Uncle George, he was a real alcoholic. He died from this disease at a very young age, along with his son. And Uncle George would get drunk, and he would do all kinds of things like beat Z.I. up. And that's what I knew about alcoholism. And I never really understood anything as far as what it meant to be an alcoholic. I never even heard the word mentioned. They just said that Uncle George was a heavy drinker. And then I had an uncle that liked to drink a lot, and that was about the extent of it. My parents, you know, they never, the extent of their drinking was Dad would drink a whiskey sours at Christmas and get drunk and do stupid things, and my mom would get a little tipsy. But I never grew up in a house where there was a lot of violence. I did grow up in a house where there was a lot of anger. My mom was a very angry person, and my dad was a very suppressed angry person. Mom expressed it, and Dad didn't. So I grew up in a house where we walked on eggshells a lot, but there was no alcoholism in the house. So the first thing that I knew about alcoholism was, or drinking, I should say, was when I was 16, I went to this party. And I tell this story all the time because it's what I remember about my first drink. Is I was working at this store, and they had a picnic in the summertime. And I really liked this older boy that was, I was in the 10th grade and he was in the 12th. And his name was Elmer. And I really liked Elmer. And I wanted Elmer's attention, but I was shy, and I didn't want to, you know, go up and talk to Elmer. So we went to this party, and somebody, we were in the kitchen. I can still see myself there in the kitchen, and this girl said, "Here, drink a little bit of this, and that'll loosen you up a little bit, and then you can talk to Elmer." And it was whiskey. And I can remember taking that drink of whiskey, and it burned all the way down. I mean, it was so horrible it tasted. But when it hit my stomach, and it went right to my head, and I can remember asking for another and another, and I had a blackout the first time I drank. I don't remember anything. The hell with Elmer. I never even had anything to do with Elmer. I just wanted some more of that whiskey. So that was my first experience with alcohol. And the amazing thing about it was that all of a sudden I felt very beautiful. I felt like I could talk, and I just felt very at ease, charming, witty, and intelligent, as I've heard in these rooms. And that's how I felt. And I can't tell you that from the first time I drank, I was a heavy drinker, because I wasn't. Because my parents were really strict and they would never allow it. But I can tell you this, that every time I drank from thereafter, I drank for the effect that it produced. I chased that feeling that I got the first time. And I chased that wanting to feel charming, witty, intelligent, and beautiful all over again. Because I never felt like I fit in. I never was a kid that was popular in school, and I always felt like that little, we talk about that round peg in a square hole, and that was me. I always felt that way all my life. I just didn't measure up. I didn't measure up with my sisters. I didn't measure up with my parents. I just didn't measure up. And I remember as a child doing things, I share these things because as a child I didn't realize just how dysfunctional they really were. I used to go to people's houses, and my big thing was asking for a drink of water. And I was only about 4 years old at the time, and I loved attention. So I'd do whatever I could get to get attention. And I'd ask for a drink of water, and then I'd bite the glass, the end of the glass, the edge of the glass right off in my mouth. Literally just bite it off. Now, this is not normal behavior. I mean, how many people here bite the edges of their glasses off? And I never thought about that until I had been in these rooms for quite a while. If I didn't get what I wanted from one of my sisters, I would. One year I combed her doll's hair bald because I wanted the doll that she had. And I thought if I combed this doll's hair bald, I would get, you know, at least she wouldn't get the doll that I wanted. That was my thinking. And as a child, my thinking just wasn't right. I wanted to fit in, but just could never fit in. And when I picked up that first drink for the first time in my life, I fit in. And I felt like I belonged. Over the years, I was what you'd call a periodic drinker for a while. I was never really a bad kid. I got good grades in school. I didn't get, my mother used to say I was boy crazy. But, you know, I think that was for the attention. I'm still boy crazy. I still like boys. You know, I used to, you know, my dad and I were real close when I was growing up. I was the boy that he never had. And so I always fit in with the guys a lot better than I did the girls. And I always felt like I could talk easier. And I think it was because my dad tried so hard to make me a boy. And, I mean, he drugged me every place that boys went, but no place that girls went. And so after I got pregnant in my senior year of high school as a result of drinking, and I don't remember getting pregnant. I honest don't. I don't remember it. And when the time came to go to the doctor, I couldn't believe that I was pregnant. I was amazed because I didn't remember it. I was in a blackout. And I had no clue. And that was the result of a daughter that I have today who I'm very proud of. She's 37 years old. And she's not an alcoholic, thank God. Of course, she lives with an alcoholic, but that's generally the way it goes. So that was my daughter. And another thing that I said, my mom said I was boy crazy. I like to get married a lot. Alcoholics tend to do that. We like to get married a lot. I was a widow twice before I was 27. And then I got married to a much younger man and divorced him. And then I got married twice to the same man again, who I'm married to today. So, you know, we like to get married a lot. And the gentleman that I'm married to today was my first relationship sober. And I wasn't really, my mother used to say my problem was is that I didn't know how to date. All I did was marry them instead of date them, and that's probably true. My drinking accelerated in my 20s a little bit, and I decided to make the geographical cure because I wasn't very happy in New Jersey. I was drinking pretty heavy, and things were not going well, so I moved to Florida. And I moved to what we call the left coast of Florida, excuse me, or the Clearwater, Florida area. And I lived there for almost 30 years. And while I was there, my drinking really accelerated. As I got in my 20s, I mean, there's nothing really unusual about my drinking that all of you don't already know. I drank a lot. I got drunk. I fell down. I blacked out. You know, the same things. Drugs are not a big part of my story. I never did an illegal drug until I was 30 years old. And the reason I did it is because the effect from the liquor, it stopped working for me. I no longer could get the, you know, I could drink huge amounts of alcohol, and I never got the effect. I chased that way that I felt the first time that I drank till I came to these rooms, and nothing ever worked. I never felt full. I never felt like I belonged. It didn't make me feel any better about me. And when I was 30 years old, I was married to the much younger man. And he liked to drink, and I married him only because he drank just like me. And I thought I had found my match made in heaven. And I found out that you don't really have a match made in heaven because you both drink a lot. It doesn't work that way. And so anyway, I married this man, and my alcoholism accelerated really rapidly between the ages of 30 and 32. Within a few years, and by the way, through the 20s, I was the typical alcoholic. I never went to jail, though. I never got a DUI, but I spent lots of time in asylums. And what I mean by asylums is crazy houses, because I wanted so desperately to be crazy, but I did not want to be alcoholic. And I remember seeing, and this was my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous, was I watched Knott's Landing. Does everybody remember Knott's Landing from TV? Well, that poor guy, Gary, he was an alcoholic. And Gary, he would go to those AA meetings and then go back out again. And I remember this one night on this one show, it stuck in my mind so much, because Gary went to the meeting, but he didn't go in. He stood outside. And all the people were coming out, and they were all hugging, and they were all happy. And Gary was sitting on his car, and he was very sad and very drunk. And I could identify with feeling like I was on the outside looking in. And that's what Gary, and that stuck in my mind until I came into these rooms. Because that uncle of mine, my mother kept telling me he would go to AAA to learn how to drink. My poor mom, till the day she died, never understood. She thought this was a AAA room. She never got it. She just never got it. And she thought I came here to learn how to drink like Uncle George did. And, but anyway, I had, as I said, I ended up, my drinking got really bad along with some drug use I was doing. And I made it into these rooms strictly by a blessing, I believe. I remember my last drunk distinctly. I was living in Florida in a place called Eastlake. And I came out of a blackout in Tarpon Springs, which is quite a distance from Eastlake. And I have no idea how I got there. And I was walking along the road, and all I had on was a pair of scrubs and a little short top. And I had 10 cents in my pocket. And the road was being all tore up. They were doing construction. I had lost my shoes. I have no idea where my shoes were. And this nice police officer came along. And it was around 7 o'clock in the morning, and he pulled over, and he asked me where I was going. And first of all, I wasn't even sure where I was. But I remember right before that cop pulled over and stopped me, I said, God, if you're up there, please help me. I do not know what is going on with me. Because I can remember waking up as I came out of drinking, and I can remember feeling, trying to remember where I had been, trying to remember what I had done, why I had done it, and swearing I was never going to do it again. This time it was going to be different. And he asked me, he said, I'll give you a choice. You can either go home or you can go to jail. You know, hello, I think I'll go home. Thank you very much. And he said to me, he said, do you have any money for a phone call? And I had 10 cents. Back then it was 10 cents to make a phone call. And I called this younger husband that I was married to, who didn't even know I was missing. And I asked him to come and get me. It was 7 o'clock in the morning. And he came and he got me. And he said, we'll go home, we'll have a couple of beers, and everything will be all right. You can take a shower. And I said, no, it's not going to be all right. I want to go to the hospital. And he just could. I really wanted help. So I went to the hospital, and my physician came in, and he said, I have a disease also called epilepsy. And epilepsy and alcohol and medication do not mix too well. And we had been having quite a few discussions about that with my physician in the past. And he came in and he said, don't tell me you've been drinking again. And I looked at him and I said, well, I've had a few. And I think he knew better. At this point in my life, I weighed 83 pounds, soaking wet. And I had this long Janis Joplin hair down my back that was black. And I had sunglasses that I wore all the time so you couldn't see my eyes. And I told him that I wanted help. And so he said, well, that's fine. I'll put you in the psychiatric ward at the hospital. And that's what he did. And I had to stay there for 45 days because I was suffering from malnutrition and dehydration. I did go through the DTs, and I knew at that point that I was an alcoholic. They sent a doctor up to talk to me, and I, for the first time in my life, I told him the truth. I told him how much I drank. I told him what I did. I told him everything. And he insinuated that I might be an alcoholic, and I become enraged at that thought. No, I'm a drug addict, but I'm not an alcoholic. And he said, okay. And within a few days, I knew I was an alcoholic because it wasn't so much in the end how much I drank, but it was what it did to me every time I drank and how I felt, what it had done to my spirit, what it had done to my soul, what it had done to me as a person. And so while I was there in this 45 days getting better, I had to gain 10 pounds before I left there. They sent me to this treatment center. And I requested a tour, which they gave me. And it's not like the treatment centers they have today. It was in South St. Petersburg. And if anybody knows anything about South St. Petersburg, Florida, it is a very rough place. It is a very rough place. And it was an old armory building of some kind, and there was four bunk beds in one little itty-bitty room, and they locked you in at night, and you were in with four girls. And it was a co-ed. There was 94 of us there. And let me tell you something. I would never recommend co-ed getting sober because that was an interesting thing. And they took away all of our coffee, and they took away all of our cigarettes and our lighters and all kinds of stuff. But I requested a tour, and I went there, and I was amazed at how old this place was. And I said, well, I don't know if I can come here or not. You know, I don't know if this a person of my caliber can come to this place. I mean, I really believe these things. I really believe that I was really it. I thought I looked great, but deep down inside, I knew better. So I ended up going to this treatment center for 28 days. And when I was there about 4 days, they had an outside meeting. The big buzz was the outside meeting was coming in. And so we all got in a circle, and these two women walked in, and I'll never forget it. Their names were Janet and Vivi. And they walked in, and they sat down, and they read How It Works. We read that, and then they started to share. And for the first time in my life, I finally could identify with somebody. When Vivi and Janet shared, they talked about their feelings. They talked about how they felt when they drank and how they felt when they didn't drink and how they felt about themselves in life. And I knew that I was in the right place. But was I going to admit it? No. And they said they talked about sponsorship. And my dad, he sponsored a baseball team back when I was a kid. So, but they said it was for free. So I said, oh, well, okay, I'll get one of these girls to sponsor me. So I went up and I asked Vivi to be my sponsor. And little did I know she was a school teacher. And by the way, getting a sponsor that's a school teacher is very interesting. She immediately said she had these little half glasses on, and she was dressed really nice. And I realized that all she had on was blue jeans and a sweatshirt. But I thought she looked, like, great. Because I had stopped taking baths. I had stopped doing a lot of things, and I didn't look so great. But they made you bathe there in the treatment center. So I asked Phoebe to be my sponsor, and she goes, well, tomorrow night I'm going to send this thing called a big book to you, which I had already seen that. But she says it's affectionately called the big book. It's the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want you to read the doctor's opinion until you can see the yourself on those pages. And I want you to call me every day at 4:30. And I thought, what the hell have I gotten myself into? But you know what? I did exactly what she told me. I called her. I stood in that line at that payphone, because we had a payphone and we were allowed one phone call a day. And I stood in that line at that payphone and I called her every day at 4:30. And she'd ask me if I could see myself on those pages, and she'd talk to me a little bit and we'd hang up. And I don't know why, but I kept reading it, and I didn't really understand what the words said, but I kept reading them over and over and over again. And she told me to read the part about being restless, irritable, and discontent until we can again at once feel the sense of ease and comfort we get from that first drink. And boy, that hit home with me after a while, because that was me all my life. As a child, as a teenager, I was restless, irritable, and discontented. Always looking for something to make me happy. And when I picked up that drink, and I got that sense of ease and comfort when I felt it go down and hit me, and I felt like I had arrived. And it talked about, you know, the sense of ease and comfort, and that we couldn't tell the true from the false, and I couldn't. One time I went to the doctor's, and he asked me how much I drank. Have I cut back? He told me I should only have one drink. So I bought a Bud vase and started mixing a gin and tonic. And then I'd go to the doctors and he'd say, how many drinks are you having a day? And I'd say, one. You see, I couldn't tell the truth from the false. I really believed that I was only having one a day. And so while I was in this treatment center, I started to understand a little bit about being restless, irritable, and discontented. And then came the news from this lady. I'm picking you up when you get out, and I'm taking you to meet the man who helped save my life and who's going to be your sponsor. And I thought, okay. So I lived at that time in Tarpon Springs, and this man that she was going to introduce me to, and by the way, I didn't know that I wasn't supposed to have a man for a sponsor. And it's probably God was right there with me, because this guy was exactly what I needed. I walked into this room, and it was in the second floor of the retarded center. And I say that because I seen the sign. It was for mentally retarded people where they went during the day. And I seen that sign, and I thought, I have gone too far with this alcohol. But they assured me that this was just where we met. And we have a guy at our group in Cedar Street that says that his sponsor told him he was retarded. And he says, you look retarded up in the dictionary, and it says slow to learn. Well, I don't know about some of you, but in this room, I was really slow to learn. And so I walked into this room, and there was this man, short, fat, bald-headed, and old. And his name was O.T. Wood. And Vivi said, this is the man that saved my life. And I thought, oh, God, what the hell? I mean, I went from... And I want to tell you, he shook his finger at me. And he said to me, I don't chase drunks. If you want what I got, you'll do everything I tell you or else, little girl. And I thought, And he was talking about how many big books they sold, and they were having a business meeting, and... You know, I wasn't too sure about this guy, but I really wanted to stay sober. So before we left the meeting that night, of course, I didn't really say much that night. I kind of scrunched down in the chair and glared at him because I didn't like him at all. And by the way, when I got here, I had a really foul mouth. And my sponsor taught me to clean that up. I had certain flavored words that I enjoyed using in the rooms. And they weren't ma'am and sir. And he would kind of crook his little finger after the meeting and tell me I had to clean my mouth up. And but anyway, he told me, he said, I want you to call me every day at 4:00. And I said, I can't call you. At that time, if you lived in Tarpon and he lived in Newport Richey, it was a long-distance call. He said, well, then drive up to Moog Road where it breaks off and call me from the payphone. Because I didn't have a phone anyway. And so I did that every single day. I would drive this car, and it drove sideways down the road. That's all I owned. And it was, yeah, it was an interesting car. And it drove sideways down the road, and I would pick up the phone, and I would call him. I'd say, hi, Woody, it's Mary. And he'd say, hi, Mary, you coming to the meeting tonight? And I'd say, yeah, you going to make coffee and clean ashtrays? Because back then we all smoked in the meeting. And I'd say, yeah. And he'd say, see you at the meeting. And he'd hang up on me. He did that every single day. And every single day that I drove up there, which was 7 days a week, and I called him, I swore I would never do it again every time. And I kept doing it. And I kept showing up at those meetings, and I kept making coffee. And he drugged me everywhere. He was exactly what I needed in my life. He took me to every seminar there was, every service commitment, every conference. His wife had a black belt in Al-Anon. And she did, really. She really did. She had 37 years, and he had 35 years of sobriety. And they drugged me everywhere with them. And he said, what are you doing this weekend? And he'd say, we're going here. What are you doing this weekend? We're going here. You got to get into service. You got to do this. You got to do that. And the other thing that he did that really helped me a lot was many of us when we get here is we really don't like ourselves very much. And I did not like myself. And he would stop the whole meeting and ask people in the meeting if they liked me. Yeah, he would. He would. And then he would look at me and say, who are you not to love an idea of God? Good or bad, you're the only one there is. And slowly but surely, I stayed sober, and I got into the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was what was called a big book thumper, and I was really into the big book. And he took me through the book with him to the best of his ability, because you got to remember, he was a guy, and I wasn't real honest. So I don't recommend when you're new having a male sponsor. But I stayed sober. I stayed sober by the grace of God, and I do believe it was by the grace of God and all the service that I did. Because let me tell you, I got learned to be real active in service real quick. And after 6.5 years of sobriety, Jenny, Woody's wife, came home and found Woody dead in the car. He had had a massive heart attack. And I was extremely angry. I was angry at God. I was angry at AA. I was angry at everybody. How could you do this to me? How could you take this sponsor I love so much away from me? Because I did grow to love him very much. But he had helped a lot of people, and it was just one of those things. And so I went to a meeting the night that he died, and it was called the Palm Harbor Group. And there was a lady there. She introduced herself to me. Her name was Sue. And at the end, she was a chairperson. And at the end of the meeting, she asked me to lead the Lord's Prayer. And the next day, I had started a new job. And I went into the office, and the girl said, I'd like to introduce you to the person who's going to train you. And I walked around the wall, and it was Sue. Okay. And is it odd or is it God? And I know God was working in my life right then and there. And Sue became my sponsor. And she was also known as Big Book Sue. And she took me, she was my sponsor for 14 years. And she took me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was able to finally be honest with someone totally and thoroughly. And that's why I do say when you're new in this program, I do recommend that you have a female sponsor if possible. If not, then if you're willing to be honest, that's fine. I just wasn't willing to be honest with my first sponsor. So anyway, I got with Sue, and she kept me into service as well. And I learned a lot from going through the steps with her. You know, I knew that when I came here that I was powerless over alcohol from what I had learned in the rooms of, you know, my first sponsor. And when I first came here, I didn't really, like I used to kind of hear everybody share about being powerless over alcohol, and I didn't really understand what that meant. And I used to sit in the rooms and I used to hear people say it. And up in my head, it made a lot of sense, but in my heart, I didn't feel it. And I asked one of our members of the group one night, I said, how do you know when you're really convinced that you're powerless over alcohol? And he looked at me and he said, it'll go from here to here. And I knew when it went from here to here. I knew when I was convinced that I was indeed powerless over alcohol. And dash, that my life had become unmanageable, that was obvious. And I still am amazed that my life can sometimes be very unmanageable today. Since I've been in sobriety, I've been through divorce. I've been through the death of both of my parents. I've been through a lot of things. And I've made a lot of mistakes in these rooms. But I follow the instructions that my first sponsor gave me, which was don't pick up a drink even if your ass falls off, and if it does, pick it up and take it to a meeting. And that's the instruction that I always followed. One foot in front of the other, he used to tell me. One foot in front of the other, and God will take you there. And I started to realize as I went through the steps again that the second step talks about coming to believe in a power greater than ourselves that will restore us to sanity. And, you know, for a long time I thought it was those crazy things that I did, you know, because I used to dance on the bar and, you know, do some really wacko things when I was drinking. But for me today, that insanity that they're talking about is I'm standing here tonight and it's been a few 24 hours that I haven't had a drink. And if I decided on the way home tonight that, you know what, I'll bet you I could pick up a drink and this time it would be different. That's the insane thinking that took me back out there all the time when I was out there drinking and beaten up and all the things that I did, and I'd keep going back thinking this time it'll be different. And it never was. It never got better. It never, ever was any better. And I say this with the fact that I feel very blessed. Since I've came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I've attended my first meeting, I've never found it necessary to pick up a drink again. And I think a lot of that was because my first sponsor, he used to have these little sayings. He used to call people nippers and dippers and slippers and sliders. And he used to say, you know, you can be one of the nippers and dippers and slippers and sliders, or you can stick with the winners and be one of the winners. And I asked him, well, what does that mean? And he said, look around the rooms. And he said, if you really want what somebody has, then go home with them and see if they're living those principles in their life at home. And so I did. I decided to stick with the winners, and I decided to be a big book thumper and all those things. And you know what? I managed to stay sober. It wasn't always easy, but I managed to stay sober. And, you know, I used to, when I first got sober, I used to have a lot of problems with that third step prayer, because I used to hear people say, well, I turn it over to God, but I keep taking it back. I don't know how to turn it over to God and let it go. And one of the biggest gifts I think that my sponsors have given me is the ability to understand that step. Is the step says made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood them. All I'm doing in that step is making a decision. And it tells you in the big book that this decision has little effect unless it followed by a strenuous effort to be rid of the things that we have within us. And for me, that was my character defects. And I do practice the third step on a daily basis. You know, I turn my will and my life over to God every day. But today I know what I need to turn over. And when I was brand new, I didn't know that. By the way, I didn't think I had any character defects. I didn't think I had any resentments. I didn't think I harbored any anger. I thought I was just a little angel. And I didn't realize what chaos that I had brought through everyone's lives. My parents, I was able to make amends to my parents before they died. I took care of both of them as they were dying, one of them for a short time and one of them for a long time. That was my way of making amends to my parents. I have two sisters, one of them who has decided that even though I have all these years of sobriety, that she cannot forgive me for my alcoholism, and she chooses not to be a part of my life. and that's okay today. I have another sister that does choose to be a part of my life, and unfortunately, all her children have this disease. She doesn't, but all her children do. And I have to say this. I'm very blessed tonight. First of all, I forgot to say that I'm very honored that Randy asked me to speak. And I'm very blessed because I do have my sponsor here and some of my closest friends, which means a lot to me. But I have my stepdaughter, Sheena. And I teased her. She said, "Are you going to mention my name?" And so I said, Sheena just moved here from Boston. And Sheena's been in my life a long time, and she's a precious gift, one of the gifts that I've received from this program. And I'm very proud to have her here tonight. And so I have to tell you that Sheena is her name. And if you, she's the one up here on the corner. Yeah, running a red flag. But anyway, getting back to what I was saying. As I went through, when I got into my fourth step, and I'm going to try to talk about the steps a little bit. I got till what time do I have? I'm not sure. 9 o'clock? I have till 9:15. Oh, God Almighty, I could dance and everything. Anyway, 5 to 9. Okay. As one of the most important things that I have to mention when I talk is I'm very serious about my sobriety, even today. I don't take myself too seriously, but I am serious about my sobriety. I do believe that this can work for anyone who wants it, but more importantly, it usually works for those who need it. But when I came here, probably 1% of me wanted to stay sober when I was in the treatment center. And I'm not kidding. I wanted to get drunk so bad. But there was just a little tiny part of me that wanted to stay sober. And that was all it took. And there's been times in these rooms that I have went through some really dark, dark times. There were times when I did not go to meetings. There was one period of time in my sobriety. And I went through I've went through a lot of difficult times in these rooms. And I just keep remembering all the things that people taught me, one foot in front of the other. And one of the tricks that I use is that if I feel my mind so full of everything, I just start praying. I start with the Serenity Prayer, and I go to the Our Father, and I go to the third step prayer and the seventh step prayer. And let me tell you, if you do that for a while, God will come back into your heart and your mind again, and you really can't stay full of anything. And so that's a little thing that I use. But when I got into my fourth step, I was really amazed at what a freeing step that was. I worked with this lady, Sue. Me and my first sponsor did a fourth step that was pretty pathetic. But, I managed to stay sober because I felt like the only people that I had wrong was the people that I loved and the people that loved me. Well, that's not what the book says. And when I got together with Sue, we did a searching and fearless moral inventory. And I went back through my life, and nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. And that's exactly what I did. And it was such a freeing feeling to finally see the patterns and the things that I had done all my life over and over and over again, expecting different results. And, I couldn't get rid of those things no more than I could get rid of my drinking unless I had God's help. And, I had to take a sincere stand and say, okay, God, this is you, and you can do this. I can't. And that's what I do today. God is a very powerful part of my life, and today I do choose to call him God. When I first came here, I was a recovering Catholic, too. And, I know, it's tough. And I had just banished God from my life a long time ago. And when I came here, I wanted no parts of God. And but slowly I said, please in the morning and thanks at night, because that's what I was told to do, even if I didn't mean it. And slowly but surely, it began to see that I got 30 days, and then I got 60 days, and then I got 90 days, and I started to say, well, maybe this thing really does work. And when I got to my fourth step and I went through and I was able to see the things that I had done in my life that were destructive to myself and to others, then I was able to ask God to remove them. And trust me, they crop up all the time. You know, there's a saying that says our character defects are just beneath the surface and not very far. And I find that to be very true with me. And, you know, as I went through the steps and I did the sixth and seventh, and I ask God to remove them. I still ask God. I do the seven-step prayer every morning, and I ask God to remove my defects of character because they're still there. And steps 8 and 9, oh, boy, did that take me a long time to do. There were some things that I could never write because those people were gone. But I recently had, when my father, I went to New Jersey to take care of my father a few years back, and there was a lot of bad feelings between my older sister and I because she had to be kind of near me while I was there. And she has never forgiven me. And I did things that I wasn't very proud of. And when I came out here to California, I got a sponsor who told me, you know, you need to make those things right. And I redid my steps again, and I went through and I made these amends. And you know what? I didn't get one response. And that was okay because I did what I needed to do. And I'm really getting nervous and dry again. Anyway, today, I'll tell you what it's like today because I'm probably almost out of time. Today, since I've come to California, when I got here, I'll be perfectly honest with you, that was one of the darkest times in my life right before I came here. I had just lost my father not too long before that. I was having family problems. I was not with my husband at that time. We were already divorced. We hadn't seen each other for 5 years. And my stepdaughter over here was one of the ones that played matchmaker, and that's how I ended up out here in San Diego. Now she's out here in San Diego. Yeah. And when I came out here, I knew that I came out with 20-some years of sobriety. And I knew that at this point I was not practicing the principles in my life, and I was miserable. And I got off the plane, and the first thing I did was I threw myself into Alcoholics Anonymous. I started going to meetings. I got involved with service. I got a sponsor right away. And for that short period of time that I was away, it was amazing that everything, I mean, all the feelings and all the things that I had learned came back again. And I no longer, that was in that dark place within a short period of time. And that's how this program works. You know, if you're new or if you've been around for a while and you're having a bad time, it's okay as long as you don't drink. And, you know, I mean, I'm not going to stand up here and tell you that I've always had a wonderful time in Alcoholics Anonymous because I'd be a liar. You know, I do believe that this program has always worked for me. I have not always worked it. And I've never drank again, but I've wanted to, but I never did. And today, Alcoholics Anonymous is, again, the number one thing in my life, and it has been for a long time again. I do believe that on a daily basis I need to practice these principles in all my affairs. I believe in sponsoring people. I believe in service. And I, by the way, if you haven't sponsored people and you're around, you're missing out because it's a wonderful experience. And, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous has given me my life back. You know, I did not have a life before I came here. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I began to realize that all my life I didn't fit in only because I didn't want to. And I found a place where I could fit in with people that really care about me. And since I've come to California, I have some of the best friends that I've ever had. And I'm glad to be here. And on a daily basis, as I said, I try to practice these principles and all my affairs. I don't always do it perfectly. And if you don't, you know, what can I say? If you don't, you don't. I don't know. Sometimes I feel like when I hear old timers come up here, and I consider myself an old timer, Well, not old, just been around a while, timer. Thanks. Yeah. Anyway, I consider myself an old timer. And, you know, it feels relief to me when I know, when I talk to my sponsor, I talk to somebody that's been around longer, to let people know that there are going to be times that are rough in this program. But this is a design for living that really works in the rough times. And it really does. The foundation that I received when I first got sober from the people that loved me enough to do that were always what kept me going and keeps me going today. And I'm very proud to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thank each and every one of you for helping me, because every time I come to a meeting and I stand out there and I say, "Welcome to Southern Cal," you probably are all tired of hearing me. "Welcome to Southern Cal, my name is Mary." And eventually I'm going to learn your names, but, you know, that's what it's all about, even if it's just sticking your hand out. Oh, I got quacked. I like that. Okay, I want to thank you for asking me to share, and I invite you all to live in my heart and pay no rent. Thank you.